Welcome to the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zachary Elwood. This is a podcast about understanding others and understanding ourselves. You can learn more about it at behavior-podcast.com. In this episode, I talk to Dino Levy, who, along with Yael Hanin and others, last year did research where they were able to detect lies with a 73% accuracy rate on average. Their paper was published in December of 2021 in the journal Brain and Behavior, and was titled Lie to My Face, an electromyography approach to the study of deceptive behavior. Their method involved attaching electrodes to subjects' faces to monitor two groups of facial muscles, and using machine learning to find correlations between lying and activation of those facial muscles. I'll read from the site eurekaalert.org about this study. The researchers attached the stickers with their special electrodes to two groups of facial muscles, the cheek muscles close to the lips and the muscles over the eyebrows. Participants were asked to sit in pairs facing one another, with one wearing headphones through which the words line or tree were transmitted. When the electrode wearer heard line but said tree, or vice versa, he was obviously lying, and his partner's task was to try and detect the lie. Then the two subjects switched roles. As expected, participants were unable to detect their partner's lies with any statistical significance. However, the electrical signals delivered by the electrodes attached to their face identified the lies at an unprecedented success rate of 73%. Professor Dino Levy said, since this was an initial study, the lie itself was very simple. Usually when we lie in real life, we tell a longer tale, which includes both deceptive and truthful components. In our study, we had the advantage of knowing what the participants heard through the headsets and therefore also knowing when they were lying. Thus, using advanced machine learning techniques, we trained our program to identify lies based on EMG, signals coming from the electrodes. Applying this method, we achieved an accuracy of 73%, not perfect, but much better than any existing technology. Another interesting discovery was that people lie through different facial muscles. Some lie with their cheek muscles and others with their eyebrows. End quote. So in this talk, I'll ask Dino Levy about their findings, about what he sees as the explanation for the results, and about potential applications of this research, and about applications of lie detection tools in general. And at the end, we speculate a little bit about how this research could theoretically be used at the poker table with video analysis algorithms to detect bluffing. A little bit about Dino Levy. He's an associate professor at the marketing department at Koller School of Management, Tel Aviv University, and the head of the Neuroeconomics and Neuromarketing Lab. He's also a member of the Segal School of Neuroscience at Tel Aviv University and a visiting scholar at the Institute for the Interdisciplinary Study of Decision-Making at NYU. Okay, here's the interview with Dino Levy. Hi, Dino. Thanks for coming on.
Hi, Zach. Thank you for inviting me.
So when it comes to your results, were those results something you and your team were expecting to find? Did it come as a surprise?
Well, it came as a little surprise. We were hoping to get these results, but we didn't expect such a success in the results. But we know from previous studies that the face does send signals, even unintentionally or unconsciously, about whether people lie or not. And what we didn't know is how well can we capture these signals in these minute or very tiny movements of the muscles. So we definitely were surprised on the success, the accuracy, which was relatively high compared to other studies.
Were there previous studies that had done something similar, or was this very much a new idea?
So there are plenty of studies who tried to, first of all, to identify lies. There are the old Ekman studies, and there are other studies who tried either using various physiological measures, like the good old lie detection, or we're using heart rate, or even using some facial information. So it's not the first study, but what it is novel is, I would say, the accuracy in prediction, and also the hardware, the electrodes, are very novel. They're not my development. I can tell you who did that, but that was I would say the second part, the groundbreaking part of this study is the use of these unique and new electrodes.
Would you care to talk about how the results of this study the accuracy of the, of this method compared to the accuracy of the polygraphs?
Well, first of all, it depends who you ask, but it is wildly known that the polygraph is not a reliable method for several reasons. The first reason is that the signal itself, I don't know if people knows, but the polygraph is you put two electrodes on people's fingers and also some electrodes on the chest for heart, for measuring heart rate, et cetera. And that's it. The electrodes on the fingers are supposed to measure changes in your sweat. And then that changes the electrical activity.
A small note here. If people are interested in this subject, I have a previous episode where I interview Christopher Moyer about electrodermal activity, which is also known as galvanic skin response. This is the change in skin conductivity that polygraph machines measure. Back to the interview.
And the idea behind it is when you're lying, you have a physiological change. One of it is you'll sweat a tiny bit more. But this measurement is very, very crude. And this is why the polygraph is not that, it's not accurate at all. That's number one. So the signal itself is very problematic. The other thing is that people can affect that. Either they can decide to increase their heart rate or decrease their heart rate, and they can cheat the polygraph. So there's a lot of studies in the polygraph that use polygraph that are just not reliable. You cannot replicate them, and mm-hmm. because they're not they're too noisy, etc. And as, so, if you ask experts, the polygraph it would be 50%, which is chance, maybe a little bit more. 55-60% in some cases, because the baseline, what you consider a neutral response or a truth response, is not very clear. So when you want to detect a lie, it's pretty hard. There is a wide interpretation. There's no algorithm immediately that says, oh, there's a lie. It's just mm-hmm. interpretation. People look at
subjective,
it. Subjective. Yeah. Exactly. And so all these results are very, very noisy, hard to replicate, and the probabilities of detecting a lie is a lot less than what was in our study and not very accurate.
Right. It gets into a controversial area because like you said, there's a range of opinions. Like if you ask people that are very pro polygraph in that industry, they'll give some statistic like 80-some%. But as you say, there's many people that would debate that and say that's a very subjective thing because it's not like there's just a yes or no. It's a lot of interpretations involved and such. So it's a pretty controversial area. There's plenty of things to read about criticizing polygraphs. Yeah.
Yep. I totally agree. That's usually what's been talked about in the field, that it's very controversial. It's very subjective. And when you go to all these, I don't know if it's in the U.S., but in Israel, you have these centers or these experts that are private entities that are using the polygraph. People are going there to take tests, etc. And it's basically whatever result you want to get, you can get out of the polygraph. It's just a matter of how you interpret it. And this is why I think it's not acceptable, admissible in court, because it is not anything close to that we can rely on or count on.
Right, which it gets into a whole other interesting area, which we won't get into. But the idea that there can be uses for these kinds of things, even if they're not perfect, which is even if they're not admissible in court. Like for example, polygraph can be useful just to put pressure on people and get them to talk about things they might not have talked about otherwise. But that's another subject.
Yeah, absolutely, I agree. Yeah.
One question I had reading your paper was, how did you decide on those specific muscles and did you consider other muscles to study?
So we decided to use these muscles because these are two, I would say, areas or family of muscles, which are well known in the literature to convey various emotions. When you're angry, when you're smiling, when you're frowning. So these are two very important muscle groups in the face that even using these novel electrodes, a previous study showed that these areas are very important to convey various emotions. So we just said, you know, let's go for these and hope for the best. Now, I'm sure that if we would test other muscle groups, we would probably, able to identify first, probably other families of muscles for lying. So probably a third group of people would, you know, activate another group of muscles that we did not record. Mm-hmm. And number two, probably if you add more muscles, the accuracy would be higher. So, you know, we would put, instead of, you know, 8 electrodes, we would put 30 electrodes on the face, I'm sure our prediction and accuracy would be better. But then you have to consider, you know, technicalities, convenience for the subjects, you know, so we had to balance all those and settle for these two muscle groups, which are very important in conveying emotions in general.
When it comes to trying to theorize a cause for your findings, what's your take on that? Is it perhaps just that lying manifests as more muscle activations in general, or is there something about those specific muscles, or what's your take on what the cause is behind it?
So the fact that we were able to detect when somebody lies or not does not mean that it's a more activation, because the algorithm is a sophisticated algorithm that knows, you know, takes a lot of features or types of information. It's not only intensity of how much the muscle contracts. So that's number one. So in general, I think the cause is when you lie, and that this has been known for many years, several brain areas are activated, and which are related to emotional representation or emotional activation in general. It's just a different emotional response. And because you have a different emotional response, a variety of physiological activations happens. So what we captured is just this manifestation. So it's not you lie with those muscles alone. No, when you lie, there is a full array of changes in your body. For example, some changes in your body temperature. I'm sure, as you know, if the lie is complicated, also body movements, hand movements, sound, your voice, your intonation, the actual words, there's various aspects for the lie. What we capture is just a part of it that is manifested in the changes of the muscles of the face. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, and I guess maybe the... Another angle on this question would be, you talked a bit in the paper about how different people could have different patterns, mm-hmm. or do have mm-hmm. different patterns. Some had, when they lied, they had activation of the cheek muscles. Some had activation of the eye muscles. And maybe you can talk a little bit about, you know, why, how big a difference was that in the population, like one versus the other? And what is your explanation for why that change or that difference is there?
The division for these two groups was pretty big. It was pretty easy to divide them to these two groups. Of course, it's not 100%, right? You define the threshold based on the algorithm, but it was pretty easy to divide it to two unique groups because the activations was very different, and the algorithm picked that up pretty easily. Now, for your second question, that's a very hard question. I don't really know why these two groups emerges, but I would say that this is think about more of a, in general, a continuum of, there are some people who are very, very activated in their, you know, on the eyebrows, some in the cheek, and some in the middle. But why that happens, you know, it's usually the old answer, or that it's probably due to their history, their experiences, etc. I don't have a good answer why these differences, but mm-hmm. we do know that they happen. And what is not emphasized, I think, enough in the paper, is that maybe that you're mentioning in your question, is that, you know, even though we were able to differentiate these liars, you know, to two groups, each, I would say, and that's a struggle, each person would probably have its own, you know, unique, I would say line map or line stamp, signature of line, even in the face or in other places. The challenge is to identify, you know, the common information, but also to try to understand the individual differences between people.
Right. So it makes me think, I mean, when it comes to those differences, we're talking about things that could be related to, like, say someone, you know, is prone to express more emotion with their eyes, or maybe someone's more vocally oriented, things like this. Do you think those kinds of, like, personality differences that are really hard-coded deep inside of us for whatever reason are things that are being exposed with this kind of research?
I would say yes. I would say that we didn't test it, but, you know, it's just and my thoughts about it, because we didn't test it. But absolutely, I think there is a relationship between these muscle activations and other behaviors of the person, and also their character and their experience, their culture. I'm sure, you know, different cultures also, express differently emotions and lies. Mm-hmm. And so it's not just, across individual within a culture. I would say in general, across cultures, probably across the ages, there are some differences because of our, flexibility in the muscles change. So yeah, there are all these important differences that affects, and it's actually interesting because you can, supposedly, if you identify these changes in the muscles, maybe relate to if somebody maybe is more anxious or less anxious, maybe is a bit depressed or not. But these are just thoughts. We don't have any, hard evidence for that. But I would I would guess yes, but, further studies would need to show these connections.
Right. It just gets into this really interesting area of all the different ways that we can be, taught to express different things, whether it's culturally or just within, like, a family. Like, if you're raised in a more vocally oriented or speech oriented family, maybe you have different patterns, these kinds of things. Or maybe if you, are not someone who likes to express themselves with their eyes and doesn't like eye contact, maybe you'd have less tendencies in that area related to the eyes. It just gets into these things that are all these minute things that can be present within a population. And it's interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. There are research studies, and even, from your own experience, when you're within a family, then people, behave similarly, or good friends behave similarly. They talk in the same way. They behave in the same way. So all these things are definitely influencing your facial expressions, and of course whether you lie and how you lie. That these all things, I'm sure, affects these activities in the face and the general, I would say, manifestation of a lie.
It reminds me of this. I was reading about this research recently where, when people think thoughts, there can be activation of the vocal related muscles, the mouth muscles and the jaw muscles and things like this. And it kind of reminded me of that, because I'm sure there's variations for how much people's muscles are related when they, think sentences or think thoughts. And reminded me of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that gets into an interesting part of your paper, because you talked in there about how this is supporting evidence against the idea that there's this universal nature of behavioral patterns, which is something that, for example, Ekman and others have promoted, the idea that, there's these things that apply across everyone universally, mostly. And I'm wondering if you can talk about, how this research plays into your view of these universal patterns kind of ideas.
Yeah. So I mentioned it a little bit, but so the idea, of course, on these universal patterns, think about these are the grand averages that are trying to explain, the commonalities across, everybody in the world or something. Yeah, everybody in the world, in general, you can see them smile in general the same way. Or when everybody is sad, then yes, in general, you probably identify in most cultures when people are sad or happy, etc. I don't think that our study disagrees with that. What our study managed to do is to say, okay, above these grand averages of, you know, a general facial expressions, there is a lot more subtleties which these old studies could not capture, because Ekman's studies, and even before that, I think even Darwin said something similar to that, that these general mm-hmm. expressions, they didn't have the technology. Ekman's studies were mostly coded by humans, you know, by hand. They watched videos and they coded expressions, etc., by hand, by their students. They had this, mm-hmm. right, this system, this method of coding. And, you know, it's very impressive what he did for many, many years, but it's pretty crude and it's not very accurate. So the ability to identify very, very tiny muscles or movements in general or information in general is low. So when you take a method like we did to finding very tiny movements, then you can suddenly see, okay, in addition to this general trait of, oh, this is, a facial expression, we can identify the differences, the individual differences, and or even divide it to several groups to say, okay, these are more unique, are more specific to individuals. I'm sure, for example, in happiness or whatever, everybody, yeah, you will identify 100 people that everybody's happy. But if you'll take, you know, very fine measurements, you would start to find some differences. Oh, this one shows, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of the teeth. This one is, only frowning a little bit, et cetera, right? It's just a matter, I think, of the resolution and how specific and unique you can identify these small features to get these differences. So, you know, there are general traits. And when you go inside and measure these small differences, you can identify individual differences across people.
Mm-hmm. So one interesting part of your paper was, if I was understanding it correctly, you said that some people would change, you know, the two different groups of activating the eye muscles versus activating the cheek muscles when they lied. You seem to be saying in the paper that some people would change that over time, like they go from activating one group to activating the other. Was I understanding that correctly, that there were, that was a factor?
Yeah,
there?
So they changed that. What we did in this study is we had two different stages to the experiment. One was that they just lied, you know, in a game, and they tried to, you know, to detect whether their counterpart, the other subject, lied or not. But in the other stage, we asked them to do exactly the same. But if they got it right, if they caught somebody lying or they were not caught in a lie, they got actual money for it, mm-hmm. like monetary rewards. And we thought that we will find big differences, you know, in general, in the intensity of the lies, whether it was money or not. But we didn't find. What we did find is that there were some subjects that, you know, switched the way they lied, whether it was with the money versus without the money. So it wasn't systematically across the entire group that everybody was different when money was involved versus not, but some people changed their behavior. Now, why is that? I don't really know. It's, you know, I can just hypothesize that it's because either for the money they were more excited or more motivated, things like that caused this switch.
Which, personality differences of all different sorts, yeah.
Yeah, it's just, I would say that it's, it's different people react to the same, you know, same stimulus differently. And it's also demonstrates that some people, when money's involved, are, you know, they care about it and they will change their behavior, even involuntarily or unconsciously, but some would just do the same. Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, there is always the open question, if instead of it was only, you know, a few dollars, it wasn't a lot of money. If, you know, if a lot of money was in stake, maybe we would see bigger changes and changes across the group. But for that, I need a bigger grant.
Were there some percentage of people that were completely readless, like they didn't have any tells in this regard?
Yes. So they were actually, it was a spread. There were some people who were excellent liars and some were relatively easy to detect. Also, the algorithm found that. And we found that also in, you know, even in the behavior, because if you average across all subjects, then the opponent that tried to identify whether they were lying, he was at chance level. So in behavior, our subjects could not tell on average lies when people lied. But there were some people that were good in detecting lies, and vice versa, there were some people, even in behavior, it was easy to catch their lies. But in these scenarios, it's hard to know if the person, when somebody was caught lying a lot, whether he was a very bad, liar, or maybe it's because the other opponent was, just a very good, lie detector, right? Could be both probably. But what's interesting that on average, the behavior of the subjects could not tell the difference. But the algorithm could.
Yeah, that gets into an interesting thing that I heard about the Ekman study of deception, which was about these so-called truth wizards, I think they called them. And so some people have criticized that study because they said that these so-called wizards were likely the result of just statistical chance. So if you test enough people on these kinds of things, some people will, just test very well due to the chance aspect. Do you know much about that and have any opinions about that criticism of the study?
Yeah, so I don't know a lot about it, but I could tell you a few things. First of all, what this sounds like is like a regression to the mean. Some would would be excellent. Some would be poor, and on average, they won't be so-so. That's number one. Number two, in those days, there was a lot of studies that if you try to replicate them now, it's just don't work. It does not work because of a lot of unintentional statistical problems that was conducted during the original studies. I'm not saying that this exact study did that, but in general, these studies, some of them did. But what I know in addition is that there were many studies who tried to take experts, like, police interrogators and, all kinds of people who work for their living to try to, that they need to detect lies better than their average population. And most of the studies either did not find any difference between experts and just regular people, or if they did find differences, the differences were small. I would say 5% better. It's not that these police interrogators were twice as better than a regular person. If they were better, it's not because of being able to read your face. It's because of other expertise. The entire scenario, the questions, right? The entire thing helped them. But if it's just pure looking at faces, things like that, they're not better. What they're better in is in tactics of, yes, they can fool you around, you can switch questions, etc. They will catch you eventually because that's their expertise. Not really, I'm better reading your face. Although there are probably a few like that, but they will be very rare. And I don't think that it's common to find these, especially not in experiments in the lab.
A small note here, just to give more context to what my question was referring to. This was regarding a well-known study in the 1980s by Paul Ekman and Maureen O'Sullivan. I'll read a paragraph from Wikipedia about criticism of that study. Psychologists Charles F. Bond and Ahmet Yusal of Texas Christian University criticized the methodology used by Ekman and O'Sullivan and suspected the performance of the reported truth wizards to be due to chance, a type 1 error, concluding that convincing evidence of lie detection wizardry has never been presented. Gary Bond from Winston-Salem State University later replicated the experiment using a more rigorous protocol and found two people to be exceptionally fast and accurate at lie detection out of 112 law enforcement officers and 122 undergraduate students, a result consistent with Ekman and O'Sullivan's. O'Sullivan responded to Bond and Yusal in a paper titled Unicorns or Tiger Woods, are lie detection experts myths or rarities? End quote. Back to the interview. For your research, do you think it's possible? Do you have much confidence that this method will be able to get significantly above the 73% accuracy that you had in this research?
So I think yes, and it's a matter of doing more research. First of all, you know, the easiest thing to do is to just collect more data. More data would cause the algorithms to become better. Mm-hmm. That's number one. Number two, in addition, we can add, you know, more electrodes on the face. Mm-hmm. Number three, what we plan to do is, because our lies or our task in the study was relatively simple. People had to just say, you know, one word, and it was either a truth or a lie. But if that's a very short period, less than a second. Think about if we could build a scenario where people give a full sentence or read a full paragraph or tell a story, that we will know whether it's true or lie. So of course it's harder for the algorithm to learn, but once it learns, it has a lot more information, and then I'm sure the algorithm could do a lot better with more data, either more people, the scenario to be more sophisticated, mm-hmm. More related to the real world. Absolutely.
When it comes to practical applications of this, and maybe practical applications of this kind of technology that's not 100% reliable, but still pretty reliable, what comes to mind for you for, you know, practical applications?
Yeah. So first of all, I want to say that this is very early stages. It's not that there is a product out there, but I think like any idea of lie detection in any product or any technology, we have to take it just as another tool in the arsenal of understanding whether somebody is lying or not. I would never recommend when you use brain activity for telling lies, or polygraph, or our muscle movements, anything, just to take this as that's it. If this machine says something, then somebody is for sure lying. No, you have to investigate thoroughly using many methods to dig deep and to understand whether somebody's lying or not. But the applications mm-hmm. could be, of course, in, you know, interrogation rooms, in any scenario that basically is now people are using polygraphs. Then you could use either in addition or instead, you can use these electrodes with sophisticated algorithms to identify when people are lying or not. That's in general. Mm-hmm. And of course, the idea eventually, you know, the dream future would be not even to use electrodes. Like the idea is that these electrodes, you can study them thoroughly and to understand the unique information that comes from the muscles, and then use that information just as these pointers or these features for algorithms that will use only video recordings and in addition to, let's say, audio recordings. And because it's a lot easier to build products, or they're a lot more applicable to build products without the need for actual, you know, measurements of the body. Like if you can just use mm-hmm. cameras and microphones, then that's a lot easier. And then it could become far better. Think about any interview, a job interview, interview, you know, at the airport, whether, you know, to get to enter a country or not. When you want to get a loan from the bank, anything that is that you want to do another, you know, trust check, then it'll be easier without
airport
the electrodes.
Security, yeah, border security.
Yeah. So of course, the first, you know, you have to put electrodes, understand everything, and then in the far future, maybe you can just use the video and analyze and decode that information. But nowadays, you know, people are using these polygraphs for various reasons or for various in various fields. You can just use the electrodes on the face in addition or mm-hmm. or instead. I think also, you know, if you record people's speech, you know, when they talk, I think there's a lot of information there as well. Not just the text, not just the context, but the actual, you know, the auditory content, the intonation, mm-hmm. the pitch, the volume, the you know, the speed, there's various features that you can add to that.
Yeah. And when it comes to these, the thing that strikes me in these areas is, you know, there's people that will criticize a lot of the reliance on these far from perfect tools like polygraph or, say, statement analysis of analyzing statements for hidden meaning. And I think there's a lot to criticize, but I think the thing to criticize is when people use these tools in a way that, you know, acts as if they're confident that it really means 100%. You know, in other words, as long as the practitioners of these things understand that these are not perfect tools and that they're just tools to look into more things or get ideas for other routes of investigation or questions, lines of questions, that makes complete sense as a way to use these tools. It just becomes dangerous when people start getting the idea that these things are perfect. You know, that's where the dangers come in. And I think that's an important distinction because, you know, a lot of the fears of using these things badly is related to people using them as if they're 100%.
Yeah, right, absolutely. Tools, I agree. Know? I think that's, you nailed that. That is very important to remember. No product or no method is 100% and nobody should treat it that like that. But it's just, you know, it's accumulation of evidence from various products or various approaches that eventually you could say, you know, this, at least it's beyond reasonable doubt, or at least even not in the court, but if, you know, you're interviewing somebody and if you have doubts and in addition to that, he fails, you know, all various, these automated tools, then it's just another proof of, yeah, my doubts were fine. But of course I agree that this should not be treated as, oh, if somebody fails this, test, then I should not give him a loan because he lied. No, not at all. Right. It's not at all. There's so much more that you should think and discuss and consider before, you know, you say no to someone to give him a job or a loan or enter the country. Of course not. Just another tool. Yeah.
And just for like these, you know, say border checks or airport security, it's also just these extra level of checks where it's like, oh, okay, it may not be perfect, but in a quick scenario where we have to do, you know, hundreds or thousands of these things a day, this person passing these checks is one more indicator that we can feel okay about it and do it quickly. You know, it's even knowing that it's not perfect, you know, nothing is really perfect in these areas at all. So everything we do in these areas of security or, you know, interrogations, it's all imperfect. So it's just one more imperfect tool to add to the mix. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the idea. I agree.
So yeah, when it comes to your research and, you know, with my poker background and interest, one thing I thought about, you know, with your work, it makes me think of in the future, whether it's your research or other kinds of research for lie detection, you can imagine people hooking up, you know, high resolution video streams from their glasses and using these algorithms to get reads on people at the poker table. And I've thought about this for your research and other research. And I'm curious, you know, how far away do you think these kinds of things are? Because I can imagine people having the motivation and the means to hook this up, and the perfect place to make a lot of money with this kind of thing would be at the poker table. I mean, I think it's a bit far away, but I'm curious if you've thought about those kinds of applications.
Yeah. So I absolutely thought about it because I'm, you know, as I told you, I like to play poker. I'm not a pro. Just playing with friends, but I think, you know, I always thought maybe I'll hook up my friends with not just these facial EMGs, but also with actual brain activity, with EEGs, and to try to understand and learn patterns of lying during a poker game. But I agree, this is a concern, but it's not going to happen in, you know, in a year or so. But definitely in the coming years, the technology will be there. Of course, people won't want to hook up on with electrodes, but of course, using voice analysis and video analysis of the facial movements of the hands or the entire body, there will be algorithms that could say, you know, this guy maybe he's bluffing now. And of course, even in the poker table, I would say this would be just another piece of information for the player to consider whether the opponent is bluffing or not. But of course, that will ruin the game, I would say, because I prefer the game to be...
Just got to cover the face.
You could cover the... Already people are coming with, like, right, with hats and sunglasses, et cetera, which I really don't like. I think, you know, it's part of... If we're playing If we're playing, you know, face to face and let's not see the faces, that's the, or when it's online, then it's different, right? But there is evidence. I think there are some studies who actually identified the mouse movements, et cetera, during, online poker games that could indicate little bit the speed of it. I think it was maybe a company or some study that actually filmed a lot of took, you know, from all the World Series tournaments, et cetera, because there's a lot of video film there, and analyzed the movements, the body movements of poker players. And I think they came to the conclusion that the hand movements are a very, very big tell. It's less than...
That was the Michael Slepian study that I've talked about on the podcast before. Right. It was like how they judged players' hands and arm motions when they were making bets. Right?
Yeah. So, and they used, you know, they used some algorithms to decode that, to identify that, which is pretty interesting.
A small note here. I think Dino is referring to the Michael Slepian study, which didn't actually have any machine learning or algorithms involved, but just involved subjects making judgments when watching World Series of Poker footage. So I just wanted to mention that. I talked about that Slepian study in a previous interview with Abe Rutschick. Back to the interview.
So if you add that to the mix and how they play with the chips and how they move their arms, et cetera, and their hands, et cetera, so I agree that it's very interesting, you know, scientifically, and to understand that when and whether we could actually predict when somebody's bluffing or not. But in the game, it would probably be, well, let's not play the game, because it's if the machine tells when I'm bluffing, then how can I play the game?
Yeah. So, and you may have said it before, but is it fair to say that you think it's possible to detect these, really small cheek and eye movement, muscle movements with a really high resolution camera? Do you think that is possible in not too long time, you think?
Yes, I think it is possible in the not in the too far future. Because the algorithms are there. There's not, you know, the development in the algorithms are there. What's the challenging is not even the high enough resolution of the camera, is how to clean, I would say, the noise or the movements, right? Because think about whether I'm moving, it could be whether I'm moving or I'm moving, you know, I'm moving the entire head or I'm moving the muscle, et cetera.
That's
the challenge.
That's true, yeah.
That is the challenge. But there are fascinating companies or even research that are identifying tiny, tiny, tiny movements, really, really small movements from videos without any electrodes. And they use it for to identify whether, you know, think about a big machine in a plant or something. And they look at the small vibrations of the machine to try to identify whether it's working correctly or not, to identify whether it's going to break or et cetera, where it's not accurate or it's not efficient enough, just by these tiny, tiny movements of vibrations that the video can capture. Or there are other studies who showed, you know, the same small movements. That was mind-blowing. Yes, that... When people are talking in a room, yes, and you have, think about like a package of like, like a snack or something, and there are small movements of the air, of the pressure, because of people's conversations, and the high resolution video captured the small, tiny movements of the package of the snack, and decoded the speech, the information that people said. So, you know, these technologies are there. I would say that it's just, you just need to, you know, collect a lot of data and to use these things and have a good, a good scenario with real actual lies, and it will get there. And of course, it's not only that. People think that you use only one piece of information. You will use the movement of the muscles, but you will also use, you know, the audio and the movement of the entire body and body temperature and movement of the hands, etc. So it will be an entire array of information to decode or to predict whether you're lying or not. So I think it will happen eventually.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other areas of your work that you want to talk about if people were interested in your future behavior-related studies?
Well, as I told you, although we did this study on lie detection, my expertise is in neuroscience and in the field of decision-making, what's called neuroeconomics and neuromarketing, where we record brain activity, mainly EEG activity, which is the electrical activity of the brain, to decode the information that comes from the brain in order to predict what people will choose in the future, like half an hour later, or what commercial they like the best. That's my main work. And we developed sophisticated deep learning algorithms to decode the EEG information, the brain information, for predicting choice preferences, success of commercials or other marketing campaigns. And in addition to that, we work on predicting epileptic seizures, actually, using brain activity. So we're using these, it doesn't matter if it's, you know, information from the muscles or from the brain, it's, you know, it's a continuous signal with changes on the, you know, the intensity of the voltage. And we just use sophisticated approaches, algorithms to decode that in order to predict various things like choices or like epilepsy or like if somebody is lying or not. So this is what we're doing in the lab in most of the time.
Thanks so much for coming on, Dino. This has been very interesting.
Thank you for having me.
That was a talk with Dino Levy. For more information about him and about this research, check out the page for this episode at my site, behavior-podcast.com. This has been the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. If you didn't already know, I'm the author of some respected books about poker behavior. My first book, Reading Poker Tells, has been translated into 8 languages. I also have a Poker Tells video series. You can learn more about all of that work at my site, readingpokertells.com. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please leave it a rating or a review on iTunes or the platform you listen on. It's much appreciated. Thanks for listening. Music by Small Skies.